Hi, everybody. David Donaldson here with another episode jam-packed of Entrepreneurial Impact. And I can't think of anything more impactful than some of the things that we're going through right now in the real estate industry in the aftermath of some of the lawsuits that came down. There's a lot of changes hitting the road, impacting agents' clarity around what they thought they know, what they do know, and such conversations that they can have with their consumers, whether buyers and sellers. In our new contracts. So with that, today I wanted to bring in Anthony Carr, licensed broker in the DMV area, DC, Maryland, Virginia, works for Keller Williams United. Anthony, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, great. Thanks to be. Thank you for having me in here. Good to be here.
Hey, no problem, Anthony. You good?
I'm good. And my discussion with us will sound a lot more, a lot better than what that was right there.
That's right. We're in edit-free zone, so don't worry about it. We're okay.
Yeah.
So Anthony and I have been in business for quite some time. I guess it goes back 10 years now. So definitely one of the brokers that I've held in high esteem all this time. Mm-hmm. But Anthony, why don't you tell the audience at home that's listening or hearing from you the first time, what's your background? How did you get into this thing we call real estate? And why would you want to don the hat that says, you know, the pointy one with the spinner on the top that says,
yeah,
I'm a broker. Why would you wear that one?
I'm broker than everybody else. That's what that is. 1995 was the year when I got my license. And that was after several years of being a journalist. And particularly, I had been in the arena of real estate editing. I was with one of the dailies here as the real estate editor in special sections. And then I was also with the Northern Virginia Association of Realtors writing their communication stuff. And agents would come in and say, man, you really ought to have your license. And so I decided to go ahead and get that license. And the rest is history. I was in sales for a few years and then got into management. And now I'm back into management and sales. So seeing both sides of the transaction there. But it's interesting, you know, this whole thing of all the changes coming upon us, and I don't want to get too far ahead, but, you know, as we'll get into it, you'll find out that in the DMV area, a lot of this is not a surprise for us because we've already had these things in place. So it's just a reminder of what we have to do to protect our clients and do right by them. So that's how I got here. 30 years now. This next year will be my 30th year. Wow. I know. I started when I was 10. Yeah, I know.
I thought I'd been in long tooth at 17 years.
Yeah.
But look, I mean, 30 years, 17 years, we've seen some changes, right? We've seen some challenges, right? Yeah. This is a little bit of both compounding upon what's happening with the market, not just some of the changes what we're doing. Normally, when we talk about changes to contracts, right, we're used to that. It happens a couple times a year, both Virginia and different areas, right? They make changes and make tweaks and make improvements. Right. This is different. The mindset around the changes, I think, is what feels different for most people. Mm-hmm. You touched on, hey, we're not really changing things, but to be truth be told, I think we really kind of are, and we're changing it up here.
You know, so right.
What are you seeing from the agents? Like, how are they feeling about these changes? What are their biggest concerns?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting. As this all started coming down and we had some folks from NAR come to our brokerage and talk to us, it was a surprise to me. I was totally not prepared for what they said, that 32 states did not have a required buyer broker agreement. 32 out of 50. We're one of the ones that did. And so there's 18 states that did. Three of those were right here in our own backyard. And so all this thing about, I've got to have this buyer broker agreement. It's got to be an understanding of what they're paying me. They got to know who I represent. We passed through that fire back in 1997, 98. And so we've had these things in play for many, many years. However, I think we backed away from the way that we were supposed to apply this information, apply these rules and regulations. For years, you were supposed to have a buyer broker agreement in place when you had a substantive discussion about a piece of property with a buyer. That's always been there, at least since I've been in business, 1995, 96. And so what the difference is like they're calling us back to our beginnings and saying, okay, we really mean it this time. You've got to let people know how you get compensated, how much you're going to get compensated, and nail that down so there's no misunderstanding and there's no questions about where's the money coming from and where's it going. So I think for agents in our area, the practice is not new, or the recommended practice is not new. The application is what's new.
Yeah, you drive that home there. I remember when I relocated here in 2012, it was even a big push, like, and maybe it was there before, but maybe it became mandatory in 12. I just remember something happened around it in 12 that really stirred the conversation again around buyer broker agreements. I was coming from a state where that was the law of the land, so it was not a big deal to me. However, what I watched, I call it like a scarcity of mindset and an approach to how I provide value to my consumers, and having the conversations that I should have always been having. And in a nutshell, what I have watched happen, and I don't want to put everybody in the same boat, but
sure, go ahead.
I've been here to a degree, is that when we do a buyer broker agreement, by default, we want to avoid confrontation.
Right.
So we would instinctively say, don't worry about it. This establishes our relationship and says you're going to compensate me for the work that I'm going to do to help you achieve your goal. However, in this circle of financing, that compensation is going to come to me by a vehicle through the seller. And they're going to offer me something that may be equal to or different than what you're offering, but I'll accept that.
Right.
So there was a disarming effect and not truly showing the validity and value of what I was actually doing for you. And I think that is what has done a tremendous amount of damage in the psyche of the agents, because they don't know how to have that conversation.
Exactly. And I think what happened is we were looking at, hey, here's your bill, your invoice, but don't worry, this guy's going to pay it. And we got comfortable in that, always thinking that the seller was going to pay it instead of the buyer. Now, in this new world, a few years ago, I crossed the bridge of this. Where's that money coming from to pay everything in a real estate transaction? And it's tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so I started using the term, look, there's a basket of money on this seller, on this table. And this was even to help the seller to understand where that was coming from. Where's that basket of money coming from? And the seller never said, well, I wrote a check for it. No, the seller goes, well, I said, where'd it come from? Well, the bank. I said, and where else? I said, the bank's giving 100% on these houses? Well, no, 20% is coming from the buyer. I said, so the buyer is coming in on a $500,000 house with $100,000 that they are writing a check for, and then they're borrowing $400,000 on the table. What's the first thing that gets paid off from this? And they usually go, well, the commissions. No, it's your mortgage on your house. They're paying off your mortgage that you had from 20 years ago. That's the first place. Then you have all the other expenses. But the money came from the transaction. The buyer is bringing the cash. They're liquefying your equity. So I have always held that the payment for everything comes from the transaction. It's not necessarily from the buyer or the seller. It's a combination of the two. And I think if you can cross that as an agent, understanding it's coming from the transaction. Without the equity, you don't have it. Without the money from the bank and the buyer, you don't have it. It comes from both of them. You can cross that and have that discussion with your buyer and seller. I think emotions die down, and I think there's an understanding and a logic that comes to it. And then I think everyone's okay with, okay, I understand now. I don't feel like I'm paying for everything.
Yeah, you're right. You know, it's that endless loop that we need each other. Right. Mm-hmm. Now they're trying to define things a little bit better. And I truly do understand what they're trying to accomplish to a degree. But, you know, it's challenging for people to wrap their minds around it. Right. Yeah. It's always been three parts of the transaction, but they're now a little bit more uniform in their approach. They are taking away some of the ambiguity, which is good. And it's kind of brings me to one of my questions here. I think, you know, what mistakes or pitfalls are you seeing agents try to do now that's going to be in detriment of the changes that have been implemented?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the good thing for Virginia realtors is that we saw this coming. Our new forms were released in May and went active July 1. Maryland, D.C. are rolling theirs out at a different time. So in Virginia, we've had to start dealing with these changes early on. The mistake I've seen for over a month now, number one, ignorance. They're not reading what the form says. They're not understanding the difference of what it takes to make that. And so therefore, they start making some assumptions. They're also using the past as an interpreter, or at least as a guiding light to the future. And I think what we have to do right now is like, look, the game has changed. The rules have not only been altered, some of them have been erased. And you have to realize what are the new rules as we move forward. So the biggest change I think that agents are having to look at in the Virginia forms is this, and that is the commission relationship, the compensation relationship is now between the seller and the buyer rather than the broker and the broker. And so that's a big change for us. It's always been that the listing broker charged a fee to the seller, and then that got passed on to the buyer brokerage. And now it's the seller saying, I'll give that listing agent and that brokerage a fee, and I will offer out something to the buyer agent as a fee as well, because I know that money's coming to the table and the buyer's going to liquefy that and take some money back for their own compensation. But it really is that the agents, if you will stop for a moment and look at the changes in that contract, it's going to make a lot more sense. And then the challenge that they have is, well, what if this and what if that, when it has not even happened yet, worrying about what might happen when it really hasn't. So I think those are the two things. Mainly it's ignorance, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm just saying stop, pause, read. Don't count on a video from Louisiana to tell you how you do your business in Virginia. And that's another.
You can count on this video, though, to a degree.
Okay, right. Well, I would no, you're right. It, watching then. Yeah, wherever you're watching from, whatever state you're watching from, you can't take what's happening in Missouri, New York, Louisiana, California, and apply it to Virginia. You have to look at what's going on in your local area. Even here, we work in three market areas, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. We've got three sets of contracts we have to watch through. And
You're only just talking about the northern side, right? Remember, if we look at Virginia as a whole, then we're talking about bringing in, you know, in the Eastern Panhandle, you've got West Virginia. If you go down south, you've got Kentucky and West Virginia. You got North Carolina, right? So we're a border state all over.
Right. And so the agents are having to come to grips with, well, what exactly what you said, like if you get down to Southern Virginia, those folks are dual licenses. They're going into North Carolina. You got some agents in Northwest Virginia going into West Virginia. So you have to be aware of what every state that you're working in, what their changes are to their contracts and their practices. It's all different. There's not going to be this usual thing. There's not a blanket that you're going to lay across all those jurisdictions. So I think they have a herd mentality that this is all just going to take care of itself. And what we're finding already is, you know, our office, I think, has done a pretty good job, our brokerage, in training our agents up quickly. And we're already running into ignorance outside of our brokerage of folks that say, well, I thought it was this and this. And you realize you picked that up in a video from someone that has a YouTube channel, not from your broker.
I do want to jump into the education side, but I didn't want to backpedal for 1 second because the one question that I've heard the most over my years of experience when talking to my brokers about any myriad of questions has always been, what does the contract say? So when I hear you talk about the ignorance factor to this, it could not be more important for them to truly be able to understand what does the contract say. Right. And I'm seeing too many people now try to interpret or reinterpret and inject their own language or spin into what they think it should say not accepting it for the intentionality of what they're really trying to do here. Right.
Right. Are you thinking like they're trying to get an easy around? They're trying to get what's the loophole?
It's the loophole. They want to reword and try to account for every scenario of whom might be compensating whom.
Right.
Right. To different degrees and understanding that this is their intent. Their intent is the seller is compensating the listing agent brokerage. The buyer is compensating the buyer agency brokerage. The finances from the contract, which are provided from the buyer to the seller, are then maybe dispersed to help offset or apply to whatever that buyer's agency agreement might look like. There's right. really not a gray. We joke a lot about, hey, let's real estate. What's the gray? This is not one of those times where you want to dance around the gray. That's kind of where I'm looking at when I'm saying my concerns for some of the agents are trying to overinterpret what they think it should be versus what it actually is.
Exactly. I mean, we're seeing this in the realm of, and some corporations will remain nameless, but they're introducing some sort of showing form that is supposed to be their form to agree to take a buyer out. That showing form does not hit the requirements of the NAR agreement. And so you're going out with a showing form, a little contract you've written between you and that buyer that doesn't hit those high points. And so you can't do that. I'm seeing already sneaking up people saying, oh, well, instead of the MLS, we'll have another website that agents can come to and put all their information in to share what their buyer agent compensation is. So now you have member agents of NAR coming to another website that's not owned by NAR, but it's operated by a lot of NAR members and say, well, here's what our compensation is going to be. And so we're getting around that rule of actually having to do what the NAR settlement said. Text, phone calls, emails, word of mouth, meaning you talk with the agent, a website. Instead of doing all of that, I don't want to have to go deal with 10 agents to find out what the compensation is. I want to go to one source. And that's what got us in trouble to start with.
Exactly.
And so the court
the
said,
communication has got to go back to the basics, right? It's got to be agent to agent relationships. You got to talk to people, right? The uniformity of brokerage offerings has gone away. Like that was part of the transition. You said, hey, some places waited to release their contracts. We inherited an issue initially about, hey, we were using new contracts and the old MLS. So that created an initial challenge. That all also came into education and quick changes from the free flow. And I wanted to say to you, right, as we're talking to agents and you started to allude to the conversations you've been having, do you think there's been a time outside of maybe when you got your broker's license that you have spent more time getting educated than what's happening right now?
No. I mean, I was a journalist, okay? So I can read and extrapolate information quickly. So I'm blessed in that regard. But man, and the challenge that our associations and the MLS have had is it's been a moving target. Oh, okay, we're going to do this. Oh, wait a minute, we can't do that. So they changed the rules. I mean, there's a place called facts.realtor, facts.realtor. They started out with like 50 or 60 questions. Now they're up to over 108. Of Q&As that they've run into around the country. And so I think part of the challenge you have is it's a moving target. We don't know what the water is going to be like when we get into it. We just know it's going to be different than the water we've been in. And so I think it's more like take a breath. It is going to pan out, but we have to pay attention. All right. So we got to figure out what's going to be the best practices. Once this NAR settlement is finally settled, now what does it say? Because it's not settled yet. It has not been approved by the court yet. And so, and this is in August 2024. So once that is finally settled out, then we'll have an absolute hard path that we can walk on. But right now, it's kind of a moving target. And so we have to be flexible. But don't be frustrated. Understand that we've gone through this before. The brokers are getting high levels of education. So lean into your broker to see what you hope,
right? That's an important aspect to that. Yeah. Like me personally, not being a broker myself, but I probably attended and paid more attention to contract changes than I ever have in my life, right? Mm-hmm. Again, outside of maybe getting a license because they were minor. Yeah. But when I look at and I hear some of the questions, and we'll kind of cover these in a little bit, and some of the other brokers, that's what I was kind of getting to by saying, hey, how much time have you put into this? Because I think that's so important right now is what is your brokerage offering you to be aware and support you in this transition, right? How many, for your office, your location, the conversations, how many conversations or how many hours have you spent counseling agents over the last 60 days?
Oh man, it's definitely.
Hopefully it's countless, right?
Just on that. I mean, it's besides the deals that are being done, but it's also the questions of the deals that are coming down the pike. And here's the thing, realtors, I mean, they're busy marketing to get business. And so they're so busy marketing to get that business that they may not be paying attention to these changes until it's right here. And then they have to say, hey, wait a minute, this paragraph 6, 7, and 8 is different than what it was 30 days ago. So this is not going away as far as the education component is concerned for quite a while. As you know, in this business, there are people that they will do one or two deals a year. The average is 8 nationwide, but there are those that they have their license to help a family member or a friend periodically. Some of those folks that don't even know what's going on. They saw some articles and next March, they're going to do their first deal after these deals, after these forms and changes have been done. It's 8 months later. So we're going to be dealing with that, not necessarily in my particular brokerage. I think our guys are pretty educated, but we have tens of thousands of realtors in this area. We're going to do about 15 to 20,000 deals just in the Northern Virginia area at the end of this year. And that's, if you have 15,000 deals, that's 30,000 sides. So that's potentially 20,000 agents you got to work with. And then it's the, who's interpreting what? My broker didn't say that. Well, my broker didn't say that. And then you find out maybe they got a broker that didn't go to the right class, or they're just extrapolating themselves. And, you know, it's all of that wrapped up into again, what's the ignorance? What do you need to do to fill that ignorance? And am I going to be able to just wave a wand and now all these agents know exactly what's supposed to happen? No, because it's not like they're in this business day in, day out, 40 hours a week. Many of them are, but there's a lot that they have that 2 or 3 deals they do a year, and they're not really paying attention to the changes until it's right in front of their face.
Well, I think when I look at that, there's something that I think has been lost over time, and there's a communication issue because we don't talk to cooperative agents like we used to because we text and we email or this, that. It's the respect factor.
Yeah,
the respect factor can solve a lot of these potential challenges of what the waves are going to look like, right? Because like you said, we have contract changes, but we don't ultimately know what it's going to mean, right? I think I was looking at some numbers and 40% of the deals that are going to happen this year have not happened yet. So I mean, you know, almost half of all transactions that are going to take place in 2024 are going to take place under these new agreements.
Exactly.
There's a lot of things that are going to change from an awareness standpoint. And I'm not saying they're going to rewrite contracts, and they might have to make more changes initially than they've ever made before. But it's really the interpretation and the understanding in a collaborative, communicative nature. How many C's can I string together there? Of saying, hey, guys, we got to get through this together.
Right.
And the agents, again, unfortunately, there are those guys and girls out there that look for the loopholes, look for the advantages to take advantage of people. When we really, I don't want to say kumbaya, but we got to come together. Mm-hmm. We got to protect our business. We got to protect our assets. We got to look at what we're doing.
Yeah.
Right. You like that?
Yeah, it's good.
We have to be really careful. And it comes from a place of respect across party lines and having the right conversation and understand that, hey, I may have learned something from Anthony Carr, but my broker might have had a different interpretation or spin, may or may not be wrong, just different. Right. But let's not look at that as a wedge or a leverage to ramrod something, and let's figure out a win. Yeah. For our consumers.
Yeah, that's what you're, I mean, I've been a broker for quite a while. And you know, I mean, I don't know other areas of the states, but in Northern Virginia, which is predominantly our business area, and the DC and suburban Maryland, I mean, I've dealt with thousands of transactions over the years. And most of our brokers are level-headed, educated, and they are well-schooled on what you can and can't do. We're very good at making sure that that is a high priority when we have these kind of changes coming along. And I think, though, what we've become used to as probably just consumers overall, and definitely as agents, is we want the Google effect. I type in a question and I get the answer right there. And that's where this isn't going to work that way. You're going to have to dig in to understand what are the nuances. What does that word mean? May and will consider. Will. Those are different words. I will pay or I may consider. You know, just something that simple and understanding. Well, what's that word say? I was in another seminar yesterday with the Maryland forms, and the attorney of MAR and the CEO were saying, well, it said will. They pointed it right out. Said, this word says will pay, and this word says may consider, and that's the difference. Yeah.
Yeah, the verbiage in the contracts and this is a challenge, like with the border agents in different states, having clarity around the terminology for the different contracts.
Right. Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, Virginia, like our offering of compensation is on the front page of the contract. It's not even mentioned in the Maryland contract. It's on an addendum. And so, you know, I say that, you know, Virginia is the world of long contracts and Maryland is the world of many addenda. They just have a lot of addenda over there. And so you always just say, well, don't worry, we got an addendum for that, you know? And so, but I do see that there's a difference in the way that the two groups have done it. And I think probably as we lay out and get forward into this, I think these groups, these associations are going to start borrowing from each other and say, hey, they really handled that well. Let's do it this way. And, you know, maybe we overreached over here. But right now, I think the brokers, the associations, the attorneys, the real estate attorneys are more like, how do we get this done cleanly and in such a way that we're not going to get in trouble a little bit later? You know, I have one attorney tell me, remember, you agents, you list houses, we list lawsuits. And so you have to have that mindset that attorneys, they get paid when they have to go to court. Okay. And so they are looking, some are looking for, are y'all nailing this or are you not nailing it? And where can we get that gotcha going? So we have to be very careful about this and be very in tune with what the law says, what it really means, not what my interpretation is of it. And don't go with, well, maybe I got it right this time. As long as no one says anything, I'm fine. No, you may not be fine. So professionally, we have to make sure that we're taking care of that knowledge base.
Is there a common theme for the questions that you're getting from the associates, or is it kind of all over the place right now?
I think right now it's more like this form change. Where do I put this versus that? You know, it really is. I would submit that most of it is technical than it is requirement. They're okay that it's required. They just want to make sure technically they're writing it so they don't get their clients in trouble. You know, that they have interpreted it correctly. Most of them get it. There has to be transparency. Again, I really believe Northern Virginia, DC, Maryland, when they were talking about the problems that they were having where this case came out of in the middle of the US, I was like, we've had all that information in our forms for 30 years. So it's not new for us. It's just a reminder that we have to point it out to everyone. So for them, like, well, I thought we were already doing that. We are. And so part of that is not listening to all the chatter that's out there and making sure that you know what your forms say and what's required. But don't try to do the listing appointment in 30 minutes. Don't try to do that buyer agreement in a 15-minute setting. You got to sit down with your clients and go through it. You don't have to give them a history lesson of everything that happened, but say, this is the way we do it. Where we're going to get most of the questions are going to be from the experienced buyers and sellers. Wait a minute. Why do I have to sign this? I never had to sign this before. And sellers saying, why is this divided up this way? I've never had to do that way that before. 32% or so, 30% of buyers are brand new. They're not going to have questions about the changes because they don't know there's a change. But a first-time seller will, because they were a buyer before. So it's understanding what the nuances are for them and how we just need to explain that to them, showing that, hey, look, we're taking care of these documents. These documents are a way for us to make sure that everyone understands what's going on, and then just explaining how the differences affect them, which primarily it's not affecting them as deeply as you want to buy, you want to sell, great, let's bring it together and make it happen. We just got to change the way that we're explaining it to them and make sure that we're transparent.
How do you see things happening? Say you're under contract, everybody's all well good. At some point in time during the contract, the offering of compensation from the seller to the buyer's agent changed or got utilized in a different capacity to where the buyer ends up having to come out pocket more than they had originally intended, even though they had a clear agreement.
Yeah.
Right. But that was between them and the buyer's agent. How do you see that rectifying itself at a transaction, or what course of action or agents going, like, that's the biggest concern I see when a lot comes up, a lot of people. And I mean, the last thing agents want to do is, is it the escrow company? It's gonna, hey, you didn't bring enough money to funds to close. Is it going to be, right. Hey, this is going to be, I can't interfere with the contract. So I'm going to have to go after you after. Like, those are the questions that I think we don't know yet.
Well, I think this exactly right. I think this is also a separation of the well-heeled financially buyer versus the one that's bringing every single penny to the table just to get into the door. And so it really is, look, I charge X and that's my fee. You're on the dime for it, but let's work together to get that covered in the transaction. Does that make sense? Yes, it makes sense. Does that sound fair? Yes, it sounds fair. And then we get into that transaction because all these fees, and this comes from the buyer agreement and from the listing agreement. These fees will be ultimately defined by a ratified contract. So we have a contract that's bringing together the requirements of the buyer agreement and the requirements of the seller agreement and codifying it, memorializing it in that agreement. And so let's say you get in there and you said, hey, I'm supposed to be getting X. They're only offering Y. We need to have a discussion on how we're going to get Y to X as the buyer. So yeah. You owe me an extra $2,500, $3,000. How's that going to work? But we've had that discussion much earlier, so it's not a surprise to the buyer.
And that's the point. You hope that you've had that conversation earlier, right? And that's a clarifying, right? Well, that's the education point. And there's a clarifying point that, you know, when we find out, which is going to be the challenge for some agents, that enhances the communication of, is the seller offering anything? Right? We hope that there's a collaborative approach to these, but in some cases they won't be. Right. So having the conversation with the buyer about, hey, I want to go see this house, you've got to, again, come back to your value proposition. Like, absolutely. And at the moment, they're not offering compensation. This is what that looks like for you.
The
assumptions are going to be the problem.
Sure. We have a thing we call broker time every Friday at 11. And that exact question came up. What if I have a buyer who just does not have the money? They're on the dime to pay me. And yet we get into a contract and they say, well, my seller is offering nothing, but put in the contract whatever you want. And it may be that, you know, the buyer, they're not going to get ratified if they can't come together on that shared compensation happening. And since they can't do that, the buyer is a bit protected in that they know that, well, I'm not going to ratify on something I can't pay for. But it also, I think, for the seller, It puts them at a disadvantage if they are saying, I'm not going to give any money back that came onto the table. I'm not going to allow that to go back to the buyer because it may cut how many feet are coming through the door. Because there are some people that they're bringing every penny to the table.
Yeah.
And if they don't have the money to do that, then it's going to, and it's not that the seller's helping. The seller is also taking into account, where did that money come from? And what is it liquefying? It's liquefying my asset. I'm getting my equity liquefied because of the cash here. I'm just joining in with the buyer to make sure that his agent gets paid.
You know, and there's things that, again, because the way we've always done things, and this is going to be a hard stop for some of these changes because the buyer was, like we said, everything was inclusive. Compensation was all part of the process. And now they're supposed to be outside of the process. And the challenge with that is, housing pricing, and I don't care what anybody says to the alternative, is inclusive of compensation. Always has been.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting now you're saying, to say that. And, right? And I agree with that. And it's always funny to me that when, you know, let's take for sale by owners, for instance, and we call them lovingly, call them FSBOs or private sellers. And it's interesting that they'll say, well, I don't have an agent. Or a buyer will come into them and say, well, you don't have an agent, so you're saving 6% right there. The thing is 6% has not been out there for a long time. And then that buyer will come in and make a lowball offer based on what their presumption is that the commission was going to be, and the seller accepts it. And I'm like, you didn't pay this compensation to anyone, but you're netting the same or less. And so it's interesting. And it's also when people say, well, I'm going to sell it off market by myself. And, you know, I sold my dad's house last year. He's living in assisted living now. And he says, well, I got someone down the road that might, it was a country house in Alabama. He says, well, someone down the road said they want to buy it. Maybe we can just do it off market. I said, Dad, the only people that brag about an off market transaction is the buyer. You get brags from the buyer. You get excuses from the seller. It's never the seller. Hey, I sold it off market. Look at this great deal that I gave them. All right. It's just,
yeah.
And so there's a reason that we're in a license, why we have background checks, why we have continuing education, why we have this information is because we bring a value to the table. And I think most consumers understand there's a value. I have a couple of notebooks, and I don't have it here with me, but I got two notebooks. One is the buyer documents, and the other one's the seller documents. You put them together, and it's a whole ream of paper. And most consumers don't understand what that is. There's 100-plus pages for the buyer, almost 200 pages for the seller. And they realize, okay, I need a professional to help me just like I would need a professional to help me with financial planning. This is a big deal. It's my biggest asset. I'm willing to pay for it. And the question now is, okay, we're just mixing up how we get that compensation to both sides of the transaction from the table. That's really what it's about. And I think
that's kind of where I was going with, like, right. Hey, it's been this all-inclusive understanding. Look, the appraisals were based off of that. Values were based off of this all-inclusive process. And if we're saying we're trying to strip it out, to some degree, it may or may not affect values depending on where we are and how busy the market is. So there may be a delayed change to some of that.
Right.
And also when we're qualifying buyers in the appraisals, again, if we're saying we're not funding compensation, but we always have, how is that actually affecting those that don't have the ability to come out of pocket that additional compensation amount that they've agreed? Those are the things that I worry about for certain classes of buyers, right? Mm-hmm. And their approval process.
Right.
Well, and we just don't have, and we just won't have answers to for now, right? There may be some lending parameters that have to change. Mm-hmm.
That's true. And I just heard yesterday through a lender, he says, yeah, some of my underwriters are not underwriters. Some of our investors are considering, well, we can give some sort of credit, which will help cover your expenses of having an agent that you're having to pay for. And they're working out the details on that and how that's going to work for them. And so the question for that is, okay, now they're financing things that are not really in the part of the value of the house. How does that work? How do the rules?
My argument is they always were.
Yeah, to a degree. There was still a cap on it. They weren't going to give you 110% of the value of the house. Some programs do. Most of them are like, no, I'll give you 80% of the value of the house. You got to make it work with your 20%. So that's probably will be a continued discussion as we move forward.
Well, listen, Anthony, I really appreciate your time today. I mean, look, all of a sudden, this is a conversation that's not going to end, but I really want everybody to kind of adhere to at home is a couple of things we kind of address. Look, above all else, education, respect, communication, and what does the contract say, right? You have got to get out and get informed and don't fall into the ignorance category, right? Because that's going to land you in realtor jail.
Exactly.
All right, everybody, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Entrepreneurial Impact and our guest, Anthony Carr. Thanks for joining us.
It was great. Thanks for having me.